nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Guys, hey, welcome back. So today we're going to talk about fast Fourier transforms. I'm going to start by kind of showing you how we got to the point that we're interested in using fast Fourier transforms from kind of a realistic example involving 1D potentials, but also applies to 2D and 3D. Then I'm going to talk in general terms about Fourier analysis and some important theorems like the sampling theorem, which actually tells you a lot about, like, especially like discrete data that you might want to Fourier transform. Then I'm going to move into the actual topic of discrete Fourier transforms themselves, both the kind of naive strategy that you might take, and actually that was commonly used until the 60s, and then talk about the Danielson-Lanczos lemma, which actually preceded the 60s, but was not really employed in a useful way computationally until the Kolya-Tukey algorithm came along. Okay. So, what did we talk about last time? So we basically went over Schrodinger's equation and kind of a recap of quantum mechanics for guys who might not have had that class before. And so we talked about some like fairly simple examples, like with infinite quantum wells, particle in a box type phenomena. And then we also explored finite quantum wells and the potential for tunneling. But then we also said that you might naively expect that if you had like a series of those finite quantum wells, that each of the particles would be confined to its own box and there would only be weak interaction between them. But it turns out that because of Bloch's theorem, the interaction is much, much stronger than you might naively expect. And then we were able to show that both like by solving what happens in real space, using a kind of the discretization in real space of our initial wave function over space. And then we also looked at the Fourier space representation where we transformed into wave vectors. And the reason why that is actually a nice way to look at the problem is because we expect to have a conservation of so-called crystal momentum, which is related to the momentum h bar k by reciprocal lattice vector. So basically, if we put in a particle with a specific wave vector k, then we assume that it can only jump by discrete amounts, and there are some constraints on how far it can jump, like because of the energy costs associated with those high lattice vectors, reciprocal lattice vectors, sorry. So then, but then when we started going into the Fourier transform space, we saw like there are a lot of like interesting ways to look at the problem, because like in particular, we're going to have solutions that involve primarily both the zeroth order reciprocal lattice vector as well as the plus or minus one reciprocal lattice vectors, because they can be indexed by integers. So we said like our low energy solution will be dominated by just those three components. So especially if you want to have like very high performance simulations, then you need to just focus on a few components rather than having a very fine real space grid, right? So it can be more computationally efficient. But if you're looking at a very big system, which may have multiple periods or something less straightforward, then you need to have like a good way of transforming between real space and Fourier space. And so then that's why we're going to talk about using more sophisticated methods to do Fourier transform. Okay, so what is Fourier analysis, right? So I assume everybody here has seen Fourier analysis, right? Like if you haven't, raise your hand, because I want to make sure everybody's on the same page. Okay, so I just wanted to show you our notation. That's why I have this equation, not because I'm assuming you know nothing about Fourier. But the point is that in this class, we're going to assume that the forward Fourier transform from the time domain to the frequency domain has a positive sign, e to the plus I omega t. And then if you go backwards, then there's an e to the minus I omega t and a factor of 2 pi in one dimension. Okay, so that's just kind of the notation. And this is also used by like a lot of FFT programs that we'll see later. There's actually in the numerical recipes book, it's the opposite convention. Okay, so sorry if that's confusing. But in reality, there's actually not a huge difference between the two. It's just that you have to be consistent. That's the most important thing. Okay. So here are a few symmetry properties. So the reason why I listed all these is that these can be useful like later when we start doing this numerically. But basically what you can see is that if there are some constraints on your time domain data that you're reading in, then this will translate into symmetry conditions or other constraints on the frequency domain. Okay, so in particular, you see that for real data, if you have pure real data, then the Fourier transform will have like this sort of relationship where if you take the complex conjugate of your positive frequencies, then that gives you the negative frequency data. Okay, so they're linked using this equation. If it's imaginary, then you have a similar type of relationship, but with a minus sign. So for even data, where f of t equals f of minus t, then you also have even Fourier series, okay? And then for odd, then you have odd Fourier series. Now, for this stuff here, basically I've combined both this and this, like, so it's both even and real data. And then that tells us that the Fourier transform at positive frequencies equals Fourier transform at negative frequencies, and it's also pure real. You get basically the odd relationship if you have both of these conditions that the input is odd and real. Okay, if it's imaginary, then again, you have like an even Fourier series, but then everything is imaginary. Okay, so any questions? Okay. So, and there's also a set of scalings, and the reason why I mention these scalings is because sometimes if you're given a Fourier series, then you may want to use these to kind of simplify your life. So the most important property here is linearity. So if you have two functions or two time series, then you can add those together, and then the proportionality is preserved, right? So if you have alpha f plus beta g, then you get alpha f tilde plus beta g tilde. If you multiply the time by a factor of a, then you end up dividing frequency. And that becomes very important in especially like time domain simulations in electromagnetism, because depending on the way that you specify, like for example, the width of a Gaussian pulse, then those two relationships are reciprocal to one another. And this actually goes back to what we talked about last class about minimum uncertainty packets. So there's like kind of a Gaussian packet of electromagnetic waves, and then the frequency domain width and the time domain width will have a relationship that's similar to the uncertainty relationship, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So as you increase in one dimension, like the time domain signal, then you'll decrease it in the frequency domain, and then vice versa for that sort of wave packet. And that wave packet usually looks something like this, where you have a Gaussian, where you have a envelope that has this Gaussian profile, and then you have an underlying carrier wave with a frequency e to the I omega t. Okay. And then this Gaussian envelope goes like e to the minus t squared over 2 sigma t squared. And so you can actually show this explicitly if you write something of the form e to the I omega t minus t squared over 2 sigma t squared. Then if you take the Fourier transform, then when you complete the square in the exponential, then you get a width in the time domain that's the reciprocal of that in the in the frequency domain, it's the reciprocal of that in the time domain. Does that make sense? Okay. And then a couple other properties that are useful to know are related to like displacements in time. So if you displace it in time, then you pick up a phase factor in the frequency domain. And then conversely, if you have a phase factor in the time domain, then you pick up a frequency offset. Okay, so that's a very useful property. So in the case that we were talking about here, if we let all these t's go to t minus t naught, right, so we let this time here go to zero, then in the frequency domain, then we'll have a shift. So we're shifting in time, and then we're picking up this phase factor of e to the I omega naught t times the Fourier transform. And then for derivatives, actually, something that can be very nice is if you have like multiple time derivatives, like if you are looking at something as simple as the harmonic oscillator, right? So mx double dot plus kx equals a forcing term, external force. Then you know that if you go to the Fourier domain, then this double time derivative becomes just a derivative in frequency. And so then you get something like minus m omega squared x plus kx equals f external. And then the reason that this is nice is then it allows us to perhaps more easily solve analytically what's happening in one domain versus the other. So if in one domain we have like a partial differential equation or just an ordinary differential equation going from the frequency, time domain to the frequency domain can allow like an algebraic type solution. Right, whereas before it wasn't possible. And you guys probably know that that's possible both with Fourier transforms and Laplace transforms, but I don't think Laplace transforms are quite as useful numerically, so we're mainly going to focus on Fourier transforms. Okay, so hopefully you guys are familiar with these properties. Like this can all be derived, of course, from the basic definition of the Fourier transform, right? So if you use these definitions, you should be able to confirm all these, unless there's a typo. Hopefully not.
So can you remind us why Laplace is not numerically suitable?
Well, I think in Laplace transforms, you need to introduce like a small imaginary component in the S in order to make it converge properly, right? Because it's like an e to the minus ST. Oops, sorry. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the sampling theorem. And so this basically relates to the inevitable fact that if you're trying to look at not just analytical functions, but like real numerical data, there's always going to be some sort of time interval between the successive data points that you're obtaining, right? Like you can't actually sample continuously, like truly continuously. There's always going to be a difference in time. It may be very, very small, maybe almost unimaginably small from a human perspective, but it's still non-zero. So the point is that you always have a finite sampling rate in any like kind of realistic situation. And if you want to look at some sort of oscillation, then you have to have at least two samples within that single oscillation in order to be able to detect it correctly, right? And so then if your time interval is delta, and let's say it's just uniform for the moment, then the maximum frequency you could ever measure is what's called the Nyquist frequency. So 1 over 2 delta, where basically you're saying that because you have to have two samples, you multiply this delta times 2, take the inverse to get the frequency. Okay, so that's where that comes from. So it's actually very simple conceptually, in case you saw this before and had no idea where this came from. And then the point of the sampling theorem, which is actually very interesting, it has some pretty profound implications, is that the whole spectrum, if it's limited to basically being measured or being transmitted at no greater than the Nyquist frequency, FC, then it's completely determined by the data that's spaced at intervals of delta. And so the implication of that, for one thing, is that any kind of like signal that you're receiving, which has to be sampled at finite time intervals, like through any channel that has like a finite bandwidth, which of course will always be the case, then there's always going to be a limit on the amount of data that can be transmitted per unit time. So you can never have like infinite bandwidth signal or channel. Okay. And then actually, like, the limits of how much information you can transmit per unit time are related to Shannon's theorem. And so, like, informatics. And so this actually gets into a whole nother branch of, I guess, electrical and computer engineering, which I obviously can't talk about in detail in this class, but I think that's an interesting topic in its own right. So, given the fact that we're always going to have like this finite spacing, then what we're really going to have to do numerically is always going to be what's called a discrete Fourier transform, which incorporates this finite frequency spacing and time spacing. So the point is, like, when we have a uniform time spacing delta, then that gives us not only a finite frequency spacing, but also a maximum frequency, like in like basically the positive Nyquist frequency, as well as the negative of the Nyquist frequency. Okay, and actually, like, those two can be impossible to distinguish when you're right at the Nyquist frequency. And so what that means is, because there's like this maximum frequency and a finite frequency spacing, then the number of frequency points that you output will be equal to the number of time points that you input. And so the length of the real time data in the Fourier data is the same. Okay, so that's actually very significant. So if you have capital N data points, then you'll get capital N of these values of the discrete Fourier transform. And then the discrete Fourier transform is basically analogous to what we had in the integral before, but now we're basically introducing like finite steps in our integration. So if you look at this, right here. All right, so we defined f of omega to be integral dt e to the plus I omega t f of t. Okay, so you defined this before. And so now we're saying, like, all of our delta t's are now going to be capital delta. Okay, so now we have a sum over these real deltas. Okay, so this becomes like a delta, this becomes a sum, and then this I omega, of course, doesn't change, but then the t's change because it becomes like we're summing over, I think, I just want to make sure I use the same, k. So we're summing over k, and now we're saying that we have k times delta is for our time, times f of t. Okay, but then we also have to think about, like, what is our omega defined as. And so here what I'm asserting is that omega is going to be defined as 2 pi times what we call the lowercase n in this f of n divided by the capital N. Okay, so this is like basically the fraction of the maximum index n times 2 pi. And so then when we substitute this, then we get summed over k And then we can drop this delta because it's uniform. And then we get something like e to the 2 pi I omega kn over capital N. Oh, sorry. And then the deltas should cancel from this, from omega having a 1 over delta term inside of it. Okay. And then the way that I wrote it here was with a minus sign. So I should probably switch this to a plus sign to be consistent. Sorry. But then I think otherwise that should match. And then, of course, this f of t becomes like f of k. Oh, sorry. Drop the omega. So 2 pi I k n, well, I wrote it as j here for electrical engineering compatibility. So does that make sense? Everybody clear about that? Okay, cool. All right, so the point is, once you have everything written in this form, then you can define a quantity W, okay? And W is basically extracting the part that never changes here, okay? So we say W is 2 pi I divided by N. Okay. And here, of course, I've defined it with a minus sign, but I think most of the Fourier transform programs would actually use a plus sign. Okay. But regardless of the convention you're using, you just write it as W. And then you get that F of N is equal to sum of F of K times W to the N times K, summed over K. Okay. So at each N, then you have a W to the N that you can use, right? And so you can define like a W prime, if you'd like, which is W to the N. And then you have a sum over K, F of K times W prime to the K. Right? And so this is basically like going to take the same number of points. Well, it's going to take basically the same number of steps as the number of points you have, right? And you can kind of keep track of W prime, like multiplying it by W prime each time, right? So you don't have to like perform exponentiation explicitly every time. But then that's going to be like N operations for each of the lowercase n points. And then, of course, there are capital N data points. So then the overall time scales is N squared. Right. And that was the most common algorithm by far used up until the 60s. But you can see that that is fine, like if you just have like 20 data points, but if you have like 20 million, then you're really hosed because that's going to take a really long time, even on a good computer. So any questions about that part? Okay. So now, I mean, of course, you can also try to go the other way. And so if you just want to take the inverse Fourier transform, it's going to be pretty much the same exact thing, except we're going to write 1 over W. And so then our W prime will be 1 over W to the nth power when we perform this, right? And then we would use F of N as the input here, summed over N, and then that gives us a K. Right. So we can reverse the order, and then usually you divide by 1 over capital N. That's the most common notation. Right. And the reason you do that is just so, like, you can normalize. So if you do a round trip, like both Fourier transform from time domain to frequency domain and then back, then the data will all have the same scaling. And then the other thing you can do is just like write 1 over square root of n for both of these, but that's probably slightly more expensive computationally. So that's why people don't do it. So this is the most common kind of notation that people would use. And so in any case, like whether you're going forward or backwards, or which sign you're using, and you always have the freedom to choose which sign as long as you're consistent, then you'll get the same number of points in both the input and output, and the symmetry properties will be just like the ones that I showed you towards the beginning. Okay, and also the scaling rules will be the same. And there's even actually a discrete version of Parseval's theorem, which says that basically if you sum over n all your f of n squareds, then that's going to be equal to the sum over k of the f of k squareds with proper normalization. Right, so you guys have all seen Parseval's theorem before, right? Okay, cool. Okay, so how can we do this better, though? So that's not necessarily obvious, okay? But there's this Danielson-Lanczos theorem, and the reason why I'm mentioning this is because this lets us rewrite the definition of the Fourier transform in a very interesting way that has implications for computation. So now what we're saying is that our f of n, which was defined explicitly here to be sum over k fk w to the nk, can be written as both even terms and odd terms. Okay? So we're basically going to let k, which was previously a sum from 1 to capital N, become two sums, one from k equals 1 to n over 2, and then another from k equals 1 to n over 2, but then change these indices so that this would be f of 2k, w to the n 2k, and then plus this sum, f of 2k plus 1, w to the n 2k plus 1. I guess this should probably be 0. Okay, so this will include all of the terms that we're interested in. N over 2 minus 1. Okay, I think that those indices are right now. So does that make sense like that? You can split it up. The point is, once you've written in this form, then you can basically use this definition here to go back and then call this basically an odd Fourier series. This is even rather. So we'll call this f of e. Of n. And then this one we'll call the odd Fourier series, because the coefficients are odd, right? So this is f of e of n, and then we have this leftover w to the n. Okay, so we multiply that, right, by basically extracting this part plus this part. So now we've basically taken a series of length capital N and divide into two subseries, which are length capital N over 2. And then the really important point is not that this by itself does that much, but that if you have something that's like a length that's a power of 2, then you can keep dividing it and subdividing and subdividing it. And then if you divide it enough times, the number of times you have to divide it will just go as log base 2 of n. Then you'll get yourself to the point where you'll have like what will effectively be like f even 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 of n, where this is basically just one point. Okay, so one input data point, and then plus f e e e odd of n with a w to the first power, perhaps, plus f even, even, odd, even, n times w squared. So you're going to basically get a whole bunch of these terms added together. Okay? And then the reason why this is significant is the Fourier transform of single point is just the original input. Okay? So that makes it really easy. So if you look at this equation, it's probably more obvious if you write from k equals 0 to n minus 1, okay? But if you look at this equation, okay, if you say that capital N is 1, then you're summing from 0 to 0, And so it becomes f of 0 times w to the 0. So it just becomes f of 0, right? If you sum from 1, then it's not as obvious that you can always divide by w, but you can see that you're just returning the original value. So actually, like, in order to perform these Fourier transforms, really the key is to be able to keep track of all these factors that you have to multiply them by and where they should be relocated. So basically what this is depicting is like a process of reordering the input. So this basically kind of prepares your data to then be Fourier transformed. So basically, we're going to now move into the Cooley-Tukey algorithm and talk about like the details of how do you do that. So what we want to do here, as originally devised and still used by Cooley and Tukey, is take all this input data and then sort it into what we call the bit reversed order. So if you look at this order right here, we're basically reversing the bits that are listed here and then using that to like kind of order all this data. So these numbers are not the actual input data, it's just the kind of the ordinality of the position, right? So now we're saying that like the second bit, 001, has to go to position 100, for example. And then bit 011 goes to position 110, and so on and so forth, right? So then that's how you end up with like the second data point in your bit reverse series is actually like in the middle of your data set. But on a modern modern computer or supercomputer, this is very straightforward to just do bit reversal. So once you've done that, then really the key is going to be perform Fourier transforms both on length one items. And then that, like I said, is very trivial. It's just return the original value. So you can pretty much skip that. And then you perform Fourier transform on all the data sets of length two, which basically, in this case, becomes something like, F naught times w to the 0 plus f1 times w to the n times 1, right? So it basically becomes the initial data point plus w times the second data point, right? So it's very simple Fourier transform. And then you just keep like moving up to like longer and longer lengths. And so each of these Fourier transforms, of course, will take like order n time. But the thing is, we only have to perform log base 2 of n of these operations. And so then here, basically, if you look at it, like you have n, order n for this first step, the bit reversal, because you have to move like each input into its like corresponding bin. And then for the second step, you perform order n operations times log base 2 of n. And so if you add these two things together, then you get like n plus n times log base 2 of n. Oops, sorry. Right. And so clearly this will be larger for large n by far. But the overall time is then just listed as n log 2 of n in most cases, right? Because it's assumed that this bit reversal is really fast for big N.
What's the difference between this one and the Denon's and Lanchow's one?
Which one?
Lanchow's one.
Oh, yeah, no, this is using that.
Yeah, that's the point. So basically...
Well, the point is that Danielson-Lanczos lemma does not by itself tell you like what to do in detail like for an algorithm. That just kind of provides an identity. That's helpful. And that was actually known for a couple of decades before Cooley and Tukey turned that lemma into like a usable algorithm.
What if you cannot separate the function into odd and even? Or it's just even?
Oh, well, so when I say even and odd, this is basically just referring to the indices. So the point is, like, you always have like both odd index values or like positions in the data set, and then even. So, but if you're talking about is the input data even or odd, then that's like the algorithm that we presented here so far is agnostic about like any like symmetry properties of the input data. Now, one thing it does assume now, like more or less explicitly at the moment at least, is that the output can be complex. And so then that means, of course, input can be complex, but it's not required to be complex. So, but if you want to have like both real input and like basically like going back to this thing. So if you want to have like real input, I mean, you can see that in many cases, like the output will be complex even if it follows this symmetry rule. But then if you have both real and even input, then you may expect like real and even output as well. And so then you can make basically certain special cases, construct special cases from this symmetry property for this kind of more generalized expression. Does that make sense? So, I mean, I haven't really talked in detail about that. Okay. But before I go into like any specialized cases, I wanted to show like kind of like what is the input data look like, and then what does the output data look like? Because this can be very important if you're doing any computation with the fast Fourier transform data. So the thing is, like, you have this input data, and then in its initial form, it's kind of in this order, okay? Just like kind of increasing in time. And like if the data is input is complex, which you would usually assume it is in general, then you have real and imaginary part for the first time step, and then real and imaginary part for the second time step, and then just keep going on. But then for the output, the order is a little non-trivial, like if you're not used to it, because the first output frequency is zero, and then you start seeing an increasing frequency where the step in frequency in F is 1 over capital N times delta, and then in the omega, then it would be like 2 pi over capital N delta. Then it goes up until we reach kind of the middle of the data series. And then we have like an aliasing between both here, like at the largest and also like most negative possible frequencies. Like, so this is the Nyquist frequency right in the middle here. And then you actually start from what's effectively the most negative frequency, you start going up in value to like the smallest negative frequency, which is just below zero. So does that make sense? Like what's going on? And the reason why it's in this order usually is because we performed that bit reversal procedure, and then we went into all those loops of Fourier transforms of successively longer inputs. So that's how we got that. And of course you can always reorder that if you need to. So that's not a big deal, but you should just be aware that, like, if you use like FFT in MATLAB or FFTW or one of the other things that's commonly used, then this is what you're going to get. And there's a good reason for it. Okay. So how much time do we have? Okay. 10 minutes, actually. Okay. This is kind of a summary. This picture kind of is trying to show how all the steps are working in like an integrated whole. So this is kind of showing how you can divide up the data, not necessarily into always like these like powers of two, but basically this is performing a bit reversal, like using like small prime numbers. And so some of the more recent packages like FFTW actually explicitly use like small prime numbers to subdivide data sets that aren't like a that aren't just like a direct multiple of a power of two. And so this is kind of a generalization of the bit reversal strategy that we saw earlier, where you basically are dividing it up into these small prime numbers. And then on each of these small prime number data sets, and you're performing basically first a split up into like maybe like a 3x1 problem. Then you're applying these so-called twiddle factors, which are like the powers of W that we talked about earlier. And then multiplying our input data times this, multiplying by Fourier transforms in this direction as well. And then this is completing the bit reversal and then transforming it back into kind of the linear series of frequencies that we saw here. So this is just kind of showing you how you can take some initial data, and then even if it's not a power of two, then you can kind of perform something similar as we saw with the kind of the more standard Kolytukhi. But you also have the option of padding your data to be a length which is a power of two. And so which strategy is the best really depends on what kind of solver you have available and how long your data set is. So in this specific case, to be honest with you, this is probably not the best strategy because this is 15 data points, whereas you can just add 10 and then get it to 16. Okay, so that doesn't really help you. But there are some data sets which might be like, say, it's 1,025 data points. So it's just over that 1,024 power of two. Assuming that you can't truncate the data, then you may be better off trying to factorize it into small prime numbers at 1,025 or something like that. Does that make sense,
so Roman? Here is no longer point. My point is more like you operate on small matrices, right?
Yeah, so here we can't really get it to like Fourier transforms, which are size 1, which is kind of the ideal, because like it just won't factorize correctly. So then instead we're doing the next best thing, which is to split it up into like Fourier transforms of stuff that's length 3 and then length 5. And so the point is like we have that alternative or that freedom to either use the standard Kolytukhi or like small prime number factorization, which is like a generalization of the same basic strategy, which is what we've shown here. So that makes sense. And so I assume you guys have already seen, like you probably took at least the undergrad Fourier transform class, so you have some idea of like what the applications are. But there are actually a tremendous number of applications, like both in terms of like signal processing, in terms of like understanding data. There's actually like a pretty profound reason in some sense, like why it oftentimes makes sense to look at stuff in the Fourier domain. And like, I think first of all, like a lot of the times it's easier to interpret data that's in the frequency domain. But actually, what it reflects in part is that in a lot of problems, the energy of a particle is proportional to the frequency, like a photon. Okay. And so if energy is conserved quantity, which it very often is because of the first law of thermodynamics, then that means that there is a symmetry in the system such that the frequency tends to be preserved because the energy is conserved, right? So if the frequency is conserved, then that means that that's something that's like kind of a unchanging or constant of motion in the problem. And so it can actually be much easier to think about what's happening in the frequency domain because the frequency is always staying constant. So you're just looking at that one frequency. In time domain, by contrast, if you look at the oscillation of electromagnetic wave in time domain, then as you know, like there's a lot of like up and down motion of the electric and magnetic fields. So you can certainly look at it from that perspective, but it can be a little harder to interpret because there's so much stuff going on. Whereas in frequency domain, you can just think about one frequency at a time that has to be conserved. And then the reason why it makes sense to look at like the reciprocal spatial domain, which is also called K-space in many cases, which is the reciprocal of real space, is for a very similar reason, which is if you have a system that has continuous spatial symmetry in one or more dimensions, or even like a periodic symmetry, then it's actually like going to be a constant of motion, or maybe if it's not a constant of motion, then you have something like the conservation of crystal momentum, which says that that you always have either K or K plus G, right, where G is the reciprocal lattice vector. So basically, we have conservation of energy. Right, and so then that means that omega is a constant of motion, like in photons. And then basically a continuous or periodic symmetry. I should actually break those out separately, sorry. So I'll say continuous symmetry will mean that K is conserved, okay, for some reciprocal lattice vector. And then if we have periodic symmetry, like in the Koenig-Penney potential, or in general in crystals, then we have K can only go to K plus G, where G is a well-defined reciprocal lattice vector. And then there are also constraints on omega if energy is conserved in that system. So in many cases, you may be stuck with just a single K, or maybe like one or two Ks and K plus Gs. Yes, Roman.
I'm a little hard time visualizing. So getting from amplitude and the frequency, like, for instance, if you have a decay in a system, then amplitude will decrease, which not necessarily will change the frequency, but it will still dissipate the energy. So it's system and non-conservative.
Yeah.
So how does that come into picture, the amplitude? I mean, first, not the frequency. Yeah, right.
Okay, so you're saying if you have, like, absorption of photons, for example,
right.
Like, how do you explain that? Like, so certainly, what's happening in the case that you have absorption is that you can think about omega as being a complex number in one picture, right? So then if omega is a complex number, then certainly energy is not conserved anymore. So the point of this statement was more in the case where omega is pure real and E is proportional to omega in some fashion, right? So either E equals H bar omega or something else. So, I mean, this is, I'm not saying that we can't have loss in our system, but I'm saying kind of in these idealized scenarios where you have like perfect conservation of energy or perfectly continuous symmetry, then you actually get these very interesting results that kind of show why you would want to look at the Fourier domain. But then even when you have small deviations from that, it can still be a lot easier to work in the Fourier domain, assuming that these deviations are relatively small. If they're very large, however, then it doesn't necessarily make any sense to look at the data in the Fourier domain because, like, you're going to be very far off from these kind of ideal conservation scenarios. So then, oftentimes, like in real world problems, it can make sense to look at both pictures, both the real space and Fourier space domains, or the real time and then frequency domain. Okay. So hopefully that kind of gives you some sense of like where we're going with this Fourier transform business. Any questions right now? Okay. So I just wanted to remind you that we're not going to meet on Monday. So When we meet on Wednesday, we'll talk about some numerical tools and examples for fast Fourier transforms. And I would recommend also looking at chapter 13, numerical recipes. And also, please email me your homework. I already got 3, so thank you. Okay, have a good weekend.